The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Andrew Sean Greer is the author of The Story of a Marriage, which the New York Times has called an inspired lyrical novel, and The Confessions of Max Tivoli, which garnered many honors. His first novel, The Path of Minor Planets, and his story collection, How It Was for Me, were also published to wide acclaim. His stories have appeared in Esquire, the Paris Review, the New Yorker, and other national publications. The Story of a Marriage is set in San Francisco's fog-bound beachside Sunset District in the early 50s. I had many relatives there, and I remember them longing for the sun in that environment. As Linnell George noted in the LA Times, the unadorned title belies the startling narrative landmines Greer has seeded within the novel. In conversation with Andrew Sean Greer tonight is Mark Sarvis, author of the darkly comedic novel Harry Revised. Many of you know Mark as the host of the popular and controversial literary weblog The Elegant Variation. It's a Los Angeles Magazine top LA blog and other top blog, among other publications. And his book reviews and criticism have appeared in many publications, including the New York Times Book Review, Three Penny Review, and Truth Dig. Harry Revised, a wryly funny take on self-improvement, as the Library Journal called it, is the story of Harry Rent, a guilt-ridden, down-on-his-luck widower who tries to reinvent himself following his wife's untimely death. I think our guests will talk about their respective experiences with fiction, and hopefully they'll both read a little bit from each of their works. Please welcome Andrew Sean Greer and Mark Sarvis. Thank you.
What a lovely introduction. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you very much.
A number of you are my friends who braved the traffic. I appreciate that. I appreciate those of you who aren't my friends even more.
I think those are my friends.
Well, I love your taste.
Well, thank you, everybody, for coming, and thank you to the library for having us. Louise, thank you. This is sort of a nice moment, coming full circle, sitting on this stage with Andy, because I first got to meet him back in 2004, I think. I had just finished reading his prior novel, The Confessions of Max Tivoli, and quite literally within minutes of finishing it, I was so full of love for this novel I had just set down. I Googled him. I found his website, it had his email address, and I wrote him a probably slightly unforgivably gushy fan letter just about how much I loved this book that I had just finished. And to my vast surprise, the next morning there was an email back from Andy thanking me for, you know, how nice it was to receive the reaction of somebody fresh from the pages of his book. And he became my first long interview at The Elegant Variation, my first Q&A there.
I've since removed my email from my website.
So... Don't even think about it. But it's great for us to be here together. And speaking of websites, I just wanted to ask, you know, this is, if you guys have read profiles of Andy that have been out there and that have come up a lot, a fact that keeps being mentioned is that he's the son of scientists, which I find very interesting. And I was just curious if you might, before we get into the particulars of our books, talk a little bit about what, if in any way, being the son of scientists informs you as a novelist?
Wow, it's sort of hard to think of. Both of my parents are different kinds of scientists. My mom is a chemist, experimental chemist, and my dad was trained as a theoretical physicist, which sounds similar, but are worlds apart, because one is, my mom would have glass blown for her into flasks, and she would boil things in them like you're thinking, and then my dad would just think about the universe. It's really different. One's applied. And so actually my dad went into military advising later. But I think both of them were, I mean, you know, I think my dad was sort of like a kind of a dreamer, and he would talk about all kinds of crazy, you know, imaginary numbers and things that, or like, what if the world was flat instead of three, you know, kind of things that when you're nine seem amazing to you. And I think mostly, like, my mom was a scientist in a time when women were not scientists, especially not if they were poor in the rural South. And she grew up determined to do what she wanted to do and poisoned frogs in her backyard, you know. And she had an experiment I learned recently where she had to have ethyl alcohol, and her my grandmother, a Southern Baptist woman who'd never had a drink in her life and had never been in a liquor store, bought her ethyl alcohol from the liquor store, I guess where they sell it for some reason, and brought alcohol into the house just for my mom. So I think actually they were both taught me to do whatever I wanted to do, because it was so unlikely that my mom would have been a success as a scientist, as a chemist at that time, that it seemed equally unlikely or likely that being a writer would be a good idea. Although later, when it actually came to making money, they changed their mind. But I was working on earlier information and kept going.
I can imagine. Years ago, I'd written a movie screenplay about a physicist, which I'm sure any physicist who would read it would have been rolling in the aisles at how inaccurate it was, and sort of tying physicists and music and musicians. But this idea that what I thought was staggeringly original at the time, and I realize isn't particularly, but that there's not such a great gap between the sciences and the arts. And I think in the movie I sort of talked about the idea that both the scientist and the artist have to look at the world in a way that it hasn't been looked at before and find some order there.
Well, I think so. I would think about my mom and her experiments, and what she went through seemed like what I went through with the book, which is that she would be completely obsessed with it to the point of negligence. Sorry, Mom, but you don't listen to podcasts, so this is fine. And would work every Saturday obsessed with her, and she would have to start out with an idea for the experiment, and then, being a good scientist, she had to get the data and draw a conclusion, not necessarily the one she wanted to get, which is what ends up happening when you write a novel, right, as we both have learned now.
Yes, absolutely.
You start out, since I've been able to watch his editing process through his blog, it was tortured. But it always is, because it's not what you set out to do at the beginning. And I think my mom sort of drove that into me as well. But I remember combining arts and sciences. As a kid, we would play in her lab. And this was so long ago that she would had computer programs on cards, you know, punch cards. She would have a stack of cards that she would feed a computer at night. And then in the morning, it would give her the answer on a little piece of paper. And when she was done with the cards, she would give them to me and my twin brother to play with. And we'd made them into crocodiles. We made a little swamp of crocodiles out of it.
Well, I think sort of going through that question of finding what the book is going to be and how you get there versus where you start out with it is a good segue to ask this question. First of all, just we're curious, sort of a show of hands, who in the room has actually read the book?
The Story of a Marriage, yeah.
A Marriage. All right, so more of you have not than have, so we're going to be...
Can't give anything
away. We're
going
to be cagey about plot reveals and the like. But the book opens with a real strong single declarative sentence. We think we know the ones we love. And interesting, I wanted to just mention that or ask about the, you know, Max also begins with a single declaration like that, and that seems something that you're fond of doing. I don't know, or if there's any communication between these two books, because I know there is some communication between Max and some of your earlier stories. But hold the answer to that. What I really wanted to ask is, do you believe that we, and I'm asking you this personally, not as an author, do you believe that we can know those we love? Do you believe it's possible? And did you know when you sat down to write the book what you thought that answer was? Did you feel you needed to write the book to determine what your answer was? Or are you just now as confused as ever?
I'll go backwards on answering those, maybe. I mean, I think you start writing a book because you have some question you have no answer to. I mean, maybe you think you know it, but you always start digging in that direction, whether you like it or not. Certainly, this book didn't start out that way at all. You know, I really thought I had a slightly different take on the storyline, and I reached a point where I had to... my problem was that her husband, it's about a woman looking back in the 50s on her younger self and on her marriage to her husband, Holland, that he was so ambiguous, it was hard to tell what people were saying about him was true. And I freaked out about it, and I thought, I can't figure out which way I want to go. And then I realized I didn't have to do any of it because he could remain ambiguous, and that maybe the book was about that. And it was only then that I started to move the book in that direction and took a part that I had written about two-thirds of the way through and transplanted it to the very beginning of the book to get a kind of a thesis statement or a, I think you had said earlier, like to at least teach myself what the book was going to be and then maybe tell the reader what to expect, what kind of book it was going to be, what the themes were going to be. And then I started to shape it that way. So whether we know the ones we love, for sure not. I don't know.
Do you feel that your insight, your take on that question is any different now at the end of the book than what you thought you knew when you started out to write the book?
Only because I talk to people at readings who come up to me and they talk about their marriages to me in front.
You have a marriage counselor sideline.
There'll be some of that later, maybe all of you.
The doctor is in.
And I'm sort of surprised to hear people say, they tell me about surprises they've had in their marriages. Yeah. In the way that sometimes for Confessions of Max Tivoli, people would come up and they would say, you know, I age backwards.
Yes.
So it could be the same self-delusion at work.
One of the things that we can reveal about the book is it is told in the first person. The narrator, Pearlie Cook, is, as Andy said, looking back at her story. And one of the questions that you know always comes up in these sort of when men dare to write as women or women tend to write as men or straight write as gay or black write as white, did you have any reservation, first of all, about stepping into that? Probably, I suspect what we feel is the same, which is that a writer can write anything he or she damn well wants to write. But did you have... Were you concerned? Did it present any challenges, perhaps, that you weren't expecting along the way? What was that like for you to be in a different skin while you were writing this book?
Well, it's an easier answer than I would have to give, which is that the story is it's sort of based on a family story of my grandmother's, and so it was already a woman's story, a woman who had told it to me. It's obviously I've completely fictionalized it, Dad. Who won't hear this either, hopefully.
Doesn't listen to podcasts either?
And I don't think so. He's a little more technically savvy. And so I tried it, actually, from a man's perspective. I changed every gender in the book. And it didn't work at all. That was not it. So I went back and I felt I had to write it from a first person because you needed... There's a connection when you hear the person's voice in the book that you don't get if it's like she walked down the street, but if you say, I walked down the street, you feel some sympathy towards them. And I needed that for this story. And then I never thought about it again. I don't know, because I think you could either, if you're writing about someone utterly different, you could either write them as a character, like write in drag in some way, in which case you're saying, I'm a guy, but look what women are like. Or you're just inhabit the character.
And did you feel like your natural empathy as a novelist was enough to carry through? Did you ever find a moment where you thought, I don't know what a woman would actually do in this setting. I need to find out. I need to ask a woman. I need to. Or did you feel that sort of from the emotional and intellectual tools at hand, you were able to put that together?
Well, I think my friends would laugh if you said that I had a lot of empathy.
Authorial empathy.
Yeah, well, I think, what interests me, and this is it's going to be slightly different with different writers, is that I'm terrified of writing anything autobiographical, so I always pick characters who I would not act the way I would act. And so I get to try to figure out why they would act differently. Like, for me, if I were a situation like Pearlie Cook's, I would get in a car and drive away immediately. And so a lot of what I spent time on was thinking, what would keep her there? You know, well, the time she's born in, the fact she's a woman, she's got a kid who's sick, and various other reasons that I realized she would be trapped in a way that I'm not trapped because of who I am at the time I'm born.
Especially the time. I mean, one of the Andy's book set in the early 50s, you know, the Red Scare is at its height, the Rosenbergs are on their way to the electric chair, and I think that in a period like that, choices were restricted even further. But
Wait, I want to move back slightly and make you answer a question related to that one. I'm so sorry, sir.
I told Annie in the green room that, you know, I enjoyed the book so much and there was so much to talk about. I'd written enough that we could just spend the whole hour talking about his book. But
it does say in conversation with, and I have some rights.
And I'm going to...
Because I'm curious, because Harry Revised is a character that, like it or not, people will wonder whether he's something like you or if they have some sympathy towards him. And I'm curious about that and about the new book you're working on and whether you've chosen someone unrecognizably unlike you.
Yeah, it's, you know, like you, I have this terror of anything autobiographical being in the book. But in the final book, a few things. Harry is not myself. My character is recently widowed. His wife, we learn, has died during plastic surgery. He has, let's just say, he's behaved a la Elliot Spitzer. There are reasons that his marriage has fallen to bits. And he's a little bit of a heel, but he's trying to figure out the right thing to do. And as I've said about Harry all along, I don't necessarily require readers to like him. I just want them to root for him to do the right thing, to be pulling for him to get it right. But I do tell people, I'm not Harry. When you read this book,
yeah,
I'm happily married, I love my wife, you know, all those other things, extracurricular activities that Harry participates in are not me. But there's a chapter where Harry's wife takes him to a spinning class. It's sort of one of the comic set pieces. And people who read my blog know that I'm a cyclist, I spin. And I'd asked another writer friend of mine when I was debating putting this in the book. I said, I'm thinking about this. I think it has potential, but God, it's going to be so obviously me. And he just looked at me and just said, do it. Are you crazy? Do it. And he was right, and it ended up coming off wonderfully. So I sort of, you know, I broke that taboo a little bit. Whereas the second book, which is not comic, it's very dark, it's a very serious, it's a very sad book, is probably much more personal because it's about...
It's a family history.
It's a family history. It's sort of set in the milieu of art that was looted during the Second World War and has resurfaced. But it's about sort of fathers and sons and grandfathers and the generations and the things that, you know, it is, you know, in a manner of speaking, it is, you know, we think we know the ones we love, or at least we think we know the ones who brought us into the world.
Nice try bringing it back to me. Yeah.
Hey, you know, it's conversation. It's a little bit back and forth, so... So that's...
That makes sense to me, because it seems like the further away the story can be, the more you actually can put yourself in it, in a way, because it's safer.
Right. And you know, the thing about Harry was that when I sat down to write it, I had just finished writing a screenplay about Frank Lloyd Wright, and I'd spent a year doing research. And this book I'm writing now was actually going to be my first book, and I knew I was going to have to do another big pile of research. You know, paintings, the war, Hungary, Judaism, all these things, and I didn't want to do any research. I wanted to write something I could do from what I had at hand, and so Harry was a book that didn't require a lot of that. I was sort of just able to go and hit the ground running, whereas you now, for two books in a row, and I'm going to sort of definitely
return
it a little bit, you have written very evocatively about the past. You've written very beautifully about it, and these both Story of a Marriage and Max Tivoli beautifully render San Francisco of a certain time period. In Max Tivoli, it goes beyond San Francisco and we see America. But I wanted to ask about what seems to draw you to these settings in the past. Whether is it that you feel there's an affinity, or you just enjoy the research, or is there something about this time, you know, writing in a place that's a little bit more removed? Does it speak to you as an author?
I'm somehow, after when I started Max Tivoli, I thought it was a crazy idea, because my friends who were here from college will know that I was a terrible researcher, and I would, you know, better in English class where you didn't have to do anything but read one book or play by Shakespeare. But I got so caught up in it, I couldn't believe what you could get out of it. And I think a lot of it is that it turned out I was really interested in how the time you were born in shapes the person you are. And so in some ways, both of those books, it has to do with that it's good for plot reasons, too, because you need a conflict of some kind, and if the society is set up so that you are completely restricted, your character is forced to make certain choices they might not have to make now. So for that reason, it's helpful. But I also found it so interesting. And also, I just love doing, you know, for this one, I read the newspaper for almost all of 1953, the San Francisco Chronicle. I read every day. In the library, using a microfiche machine, you know,
And I mean, you really tighten in on this, whereas Max moves through
a
number of ages.
You know, it's about 60 years.
This is really you focused on a period in time. And
which kind of terrified me because I didn't have the big canvas to just go sprawling everywhere. I had 6 months in 1953 in a sort of foggy part of town, and I didn't know whether anything was happening at the time. And it was shocking what was happening nationally, but also what most shocked me and really, I think, set the tone for the book was that you would read the paper and it would say, world ends tomorrow, sail Tuesday. You know, it was this conflict of anxiety and everything's fine, folks, keep going. Every day in the paper, which I think you will find in today's paper as well.
I was saying, and almost on today's TV news, too.
I think you'll find it almost in every paper. I think that is what sells papers, is that combo. And you're like, oh, what a great new dress I could wear to that party, except the world's ending tomorrow. But I'll do both.
Cognitive dissonance at work there.
Yeah, and so it was amazing to read. And so the book is full of that anxiety, I think, because I got so freaked out reading the paper.
There's a lovely bit that sort of runs through the book where the narrator, Pearlie, her husband suffers from a interesting heart ailment, and so she clips the disturbing stories out of the newspaper before he gets them so that he won't see them. And I sort of love that image. I could see him sitting over this, you know, sort of Swiss cheese bit of newspaper and thinking about what was being elided from his daily story there. That was a very, I thought, a resonant image.
And she does later think, like, you know, even a child knows what's been left out. They can tell.
Exactly.
So what does he think of this? She's always wondering, what does he think is going on? She has a barkless dog.
In this book, there's a lot that's hiding in the silences, I think. Both of these two questions lend themselves to both of us talking, so I've selected the next two.
Maybe it's time for a reading.
A reading. I think that's an excellent idea. I think Andy is going to start.
Okay, I'll start.
And he will read a little bit to you from The Story of a Marriage.
I'm going to read pretty far along because there'll be no setup necessary. And if you know something about Ethel Rosenberg, this is right when Pearlie has read about, she's been following the Rosenberg story, and who were sentenced to death for treason in 1952, and 1953 they were electrocuted. America, you give a lovely death. That same summer, Ethel Rosenberg was electrocuted. The last time she saw her husband was minutes before he was taken to the chair in a room where a screen separated the traitors so they could not touch. They were left alone. No one knows what they said to each other. But when the warden entered the room and separated the couple, leading Julius away, it is said he found the screen blotted with blood. They had tried to reach each other through the mesh. In a moment, we can only imagine they had pressed their fingers together with such passion that blood flowed down their hands. Be comforted then, she wrote her sons that day, that we were serene and understood with the deepest kind of understanding that civilization had not as yet progressed to the point where life did not have to be lost for the sake of life. Julius died instantly in the electric chair, and when they cleared his body away and led Ethel in, she was so small that the electrodes couldn't properly fit her head. When I read that it took two electric shocks to kill her, I sat down at my kitchen table and cried. Why, Ethel, didn't you confess after Julius died? He was gone. There was no good to be done. I'll never know why you didn't pull the matron close to you and say anything to save your life, save your sons, say anything they wanted to hear. You must know some secret I can't guess. What is a wife? If they take away her children, her husband, her house and belongings, if they send down a destroying angel to this female Job and tear one son from her arms and another from the schoolhouse so his textbook falls to the floor with a thud, send agents to drag her husband from his home, if they take away the telephone table in the hall, the geraniums wilting in the flower box and the greens that have to be used before they go bad and the new hat that she hasn't yet figured out how to wear, if they take away the dog, if they take away her favorite wooden spoon, her brother, her ring, what is the smallest atom of a wife that cannot be split apart? Only you could ever say, Ethel, and you died silent.
Lovely. Yeah. Don't, absolutely. All right. I want to talk for a minute about literary influences, literary forebears, because I think both of our books are in conversation with older books, as we are in conversation with one another. When John Banville, who was on this stage not too long ago, has said that he takes an enormous amount of care when he writes the first page of his novel, of a novel, because he's basically telling the reader how to read the rest of the book. It's sort of the Rosetta Stone for all that follows. And right within the first page, or perhaps the first page and a half, your narrator references three authors, Flaubert, Ford, and Ferber. These are all pretty resonant choices, certainly. Flaubert for Tales of Domesticity Gone Awry, or Secrets and Things not Told. I'm going to come back to Ford Madox Ford, because that, I think, is the one that perhaps interests us both the most. And sort of Which One Does Not Belong, Edna Ferber, which was sort of an obscure, somewhat more obscure choice, but one of the things that Ferber's sort of body of work was noted for was this demonstration of this belief that people are people, but not so pretty people or more plain people have the best character. And that is an idea that really runs through this book, although this seems to be refuted at turns. It's not, you're definitely in conversation with that idea as well. So I was wondering if you might, setting aside Ford for a moment, because we'll come back to
okay.
you, talk about those literary influences that, you know, were woven into this novel.
Well, it's a tough one, because I feel like it's something that I put in there for myself, and because they had three F's in them. But,
so it was just alliteration? And
it was not. It was, well, like, you know, Flaubert, certainly. You know, I reread Madame Bovary before I did this because I thought of them both as women caught up in a fantasy of the life they're going to have that is constantly disappointed by reality and by men and by money. Well, Ford Madox Ford, we can talk about a little bit. And Ferber, I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about, particularly, I was trying to find an author she would have read that would have had a sort of a grand American romantic image that she could follow, that would inform her own sort of idea of what her life could be like in that way.
When I interviewed Andy in 2004, and the obligatory last question is, what are you working on next? When you had just begun working on this book, and you said you were rereading The Good Soldier and how much you were loving it. And those of you who have read or not read The Good Soldier, Ford Madox Ford novel, is built very similarly. It's framed very similarly. It's sort of looking back. There are pieces of information that we think we know at the outset that are turned on their head as we read through. And there's a recurrent motif of weak hearts, bad hearts, characters who are having heart trouble, all of which have been carried over into this book. You had this story of your family, you had the story of your grandparents, and how did sort of The Good Soldier come along, and did that become your sort of eureka moment of saying, this is how I can tell this story, or how did those two parts come together?
I think that was it. I think it was, and I apologize to you who haven't read, or I don't apologize, I feel sorry for you who have not read The Good Soldier.
Shame on you.
But there's probably most of you. You know, it's a pretty old book.
It's actually available entirely online, you know, the entire text, which is a miserable
way
to read it.
I don't
recommend
online.
It, but yeah.
But it's really incredible. And, you know, you think we're sitting up here and talking about some unreadable literary book. It is a action-filled book. As far as I can tell, there's suicide and arsenic and
Betrayal. And all that
great.
Good stuff.
I think what it was, I think, you know, when you start out working on a book, you try to find a way into it. You try to find how you're going to structure it, how you're going to do it. I mean, that's always, everyone always thinks that the hard part is finding the characters or the story, which is kind of the easy part. The hard part is the storytelling itself, as those who work in Hollywood, I'm sure, are aware. You know, that it's, you work over and over and over on getting the pacing right. And once I thought about The Good Soldier, I thought, there's a lot of stuff here that I can pay homage to.
Steal.
And completely steal, and including one line I put entirely, just to be overt about it, into the book. But then there came a point where I had to put it away because I was too, I was trying to follow it too closely, and my book had veered away from it. And so I was getting really caught up in trying to make it a retelling of The Good Soldier, which didn't work. So instead I started to lean towards Edith Wharton's The Age of Innocence. and the book sort of starts to move that way, and then I combined them. But I loved in The Good Soldier the revelations that the narrator very innocently supposedly gives you.
Yeah, I just reread The Good Soldier in preparation for this discussion, so it's fresh
in
my mind.
Preparation and for this discussion.
It is really, it's almost sort of dropped, you know, it's dropped casually, and then you stop, and you're like, wait a minute. You know, nothing leading up to this moment has given you any indication that this revelation is coming, and there it is, just sort of tossed out there.
The one thing I wish I could have put in, but I could not figure out how to do it, is there's one point where a young woman is dead and falls into a trunk, right? And she, with her mass of hair, she falls into the trunk and her hair covers her body and it's closing on her like the mouth of a crocodile or something. And in the book, it is a comic image. It's hard to really bring it across here.
Yeah, yeah.
I found it so, it's still with me, but I couldn't figure out how to get someone into a trunk in the book.
Well, I've got a necktie getting stuck in a coffin lid.
But could be it.
In the case of my book, obviously the conversation was with the Count of Monte Cristo. And
yeah.
I think people who read my blog were expecting I would write this sort of Banville-esque, very sort of hermetic, literary, plotless wonder. And in fact, I wrote this sort of tribute to one of the kings of narrative, you know, Alexander Dumas. There's a whole, you know, blood battle going on in the world of literary fiction. Is plot good or bad? And I certainly am down on the side of folks who say, you know, plot, yes. And I
wish I could take the other side, but I can't.
And so, you know, we're two against none here. But that became a framing device for me where, you know, in my book, my character's really seeking to, he wants to reinvent himself after the wake of, you know, the death of his wife, for which he may have some indirect responsibility. And you know, who was a greater self-inventor than Edmond Dantes, although, as he found at the end, it wasn't perhaps as satisfying as he had hoped or had expected. And that one sort of fell into my lap very accidentally, and I realized, oh my God, this is a great...
But I think, like, I've talked to writing students who think it's bizarre to make a reference to an old book in that way, or to steal from it, and they think they're a little accusatory about it. They're like, are you lazy, or what?
Just a bunch of humorless prats, these writing students. No, I even have the chapters open up with these little headings, you know, in which our hero, which really sort of harkens back to that old style of, you know.
And he doesn't need to order a Monte Cristo in a restaurant.
He does. That was the moment, because I had just randomly had him order the Monte Cristo. And then I sat back and I realized, oh my God, this is what I can use for the rest of the book. The other question that I think we can both speak to, and we were talking about this in the green room a little bit before. We've sort of been twisting ourselves a little gymnastically into some knots here, because there are a number of very interesting and exciting plot reveals in Andy's book, as in The Good Soldier, which we are going to pains not to betray here. But it raised the question of withholding information as a novelist, as a writer, and we both do that. I do that as well in my book, although I think I do it a bit more cheaply, a little less elegantly than Andy
does. I think that's absolutely true.
And and I know I was uneasy when I did it, because it felt, for me, it felt a little bit like I was manipulating my privileged position as the author. And one of the arguments for it, obviously, is it helps propel narrative. It helps, you know, your narrative engine. It gives people a reason to turn the pages. But it feels like, if the only reason they're turning the pages are because I'm withholding this, I'm not really doing my job. So I had a pretty ambivalent feeling about, well, obviously in the end I did it because I'm cheap and I want you to turn the pages, and it was the best I had. But I'm curious how you approach, and what are your feelings, and maybe you have no misgivings, or what do you think about withholding information in literature?
I mean, I think I'm just as cheap as you, and I don't think it's a bad reason. I think the job is to figure out what are the pleasures of reading, and they're varied, and some of them are philosophical thought and character and the beauty of language, and some of them are cliffhangers and surprises and narrative, the joys of reading narrative, and I think those are equally there, and I love to see them all in a book if they're well done. And so some of the withholding, in my book that I can think of is you know, there'll be an example of, like, when she's about to get married, her husband-to-be's aunts meet with her in a tea shop, and one of them suddenly blurts out something amazing and startling that she didn't quite think she heard right. And then only a couple pages later, she says, "I tried not to think about the time she yelled, 'Don't marry him, don't do it.'" You know, it's withheld. Actually, that time, I'm hoping that you'll forget about it, and then you'll go back and think about it again. But it's also, but again, it's reminding you in the narrative that there's, you have to be paying attention to everything that's going on, and it creates maybe some anxiety that you have to look carefully at what's going on.
And I think something we both do is perhaps wanting to challenge just a reader's assumptions. I mean, in my book, as I said, I make no secret of the fact that Harry is a widower. But in the first chapter, if you were just picking the book up cold, you wouldn't know this. And he's sitting in a cafe ordering a sandwich, flirting with a waitress, when in fact he's meant to be on the way to his wife's funeral. And that's the last line of that chapter gives you that information. But I sort of felt you read the chapter one way when you don't know it, and then you read it differently when you do know it, and that was interesting to me. And I think there's something similar going on with some of the pieces of information that you...
Yeah, there's a lot. Well, I wanted it to be that, I wanted to be the reader to have to confront their own assumptions at one point in the book about the assumptions they have going into the book about the characters they're reading about. So I was curious to see what would happen to a reader. So if you call that cruel and manipulative, absolutely.
Bring it.
But it gave me great pleasure to do it, and unfortunately, in interview after interview, I don't get to talk about it. I'm under strict instructions.
We're talking about it today.
Okay, a little bit.
A little bit.
How about another reading?
I will read a very, very brief section from Harry Revised, and like Andy's, it doesn't require much setup. Only, and for the handful of you who have been to my bookstore readings, I apologize, you're going to hear the same thing again. But it's just because I know it well. And it's the point in the story in which my character realizes that if he's going to pattern himself after the Count of Monte Cristo, he should probably go and pick up a copy and read it. So he goes into a bookstore. And chapter 7 is In Which Our Hero Spills Blood. And I must warn you, it is not anywhere near as serious, touching, or lovely as Andy's. It's more tawdry and comic. So
absolutely true.
Abridged or unabridged? That is the question. Harry stands in the deserted, brightly lit fiction and literature section of his favorite chain bookstore, weighing a book in each hand. In his right, The Count of Monte Cristo, Penguin, unabridged, weighing in at a formidable 1,276 pages. In his left, The Count of Monte Cristo, Puffin Classics, abridged, tipping the scales at a svelte 396 pages. Harry weighs the pros and cons of each, literally as well as figuratively. He can't deny that an irresistible bit of cachet comes with being an unabridged sort of guy. If depth follows effort, as Harry is reasonably convinced that it must, surely his best hope for a Dante's-esque rebirth must be found in these pages. But Harry also knows himself, knows the limits of his attention span, and fears that the Count of Monte Cristo, Penguin unabridged, is fated to end up as little more than an impressive desk ornament. And he reasons if the story can effectively be whittled down to a mere 396 pages, Puffin Classics abridged, then how necessary can the rest really be? Harry's a bit under the gun, eager to move along his grand scheme, and he's not sure he's got the time to accommodate what must clearly be 900 pages of authorial self-indulgence. And yet, knowledge is power, and Harry considers the effect of having an additional 900 pages, Penguin unabridged, of power at his beck and call. And what if some essential nugget of wisdom, some brilliant bit of planning, is located in that 900 pages, somewhere, its value unappreciated by the underpaid junior editor who hacked away to produce the mini-book, Puffin Classics Abridged? Still, there are practical considerations. Transportation, for example. Harry anticipates the inconvenience of hauling around a monster tome, Penguin unabridged, and realizes that the Puffin Classics Abridged will fit comfortably in his pocket, his briefcase, and resting on the crest of his belly in bed. To his credit, however, this strikes him as an exceptionally shallow basis on which to choose a book, particularly one with anticipated life-altering effects. What to do? As he always does when faced with seemingly impossible choices, Harry punts the decision. And then he asks the bookstore clerk what to do, so I'll stop there. We have a little time left before we want to go over to questions, and we had a number of exciting threads. You should have been in the green room with us, folks.
We didn't
were having
get
a great
any more
time
close,
there.
Yeah.
And the two sort of threads that we were talking about, because I don't know if we'll have time for both, unless we have no questions, and then we can do both, is one had to do with the whole question of, you know, happiness real versus perceived, and then the other one about reviewing in general, which is more interesting to you for us to maybe pursue and talk about right now.
Reviewing in general? All maybe right. Not for the audience. They could vote on it. They probably want to talk about happiness.
I'm sorry? Did we have a... thought we had a vote there.
Well, but maybe we could plant it as a question for you later.
That's right. Well, we were talking back there about, and in the case of Andy's book, about sort of the reviewer's insistence to reveal some of these plot points that we have gone to sort of great lengths to keep to ourselves. And wondering sort of what are the obligations of the reviewer. You know, perhaps we'd sort of steer away from the general state of book reviewing, although...
Well, I kind of wonder, because, and I think you might have... Luckily, we might argue for once about this, because it made me wonder, well, what is a book review? I wonder, because is a book review meant to discuss books in a sort of an intellectual basis, one against the other, in which case you should review the book as a whole.
Right.
You know, you have to talk about every part of it, and New York Review of Books does that,
right,
for sure.
Exactly.
Or is it a consumer guide?
You've framed the question almost verbatim as I framed it when I was having an argument with the National Book Critics Circle, of which I'm a member, but I never go quietly into, you know, gently into the good night, where I was challenging that question, saying that I don't know that there's a single answer, because I think that there is the New York Review of Books for places like that sort of criticism, and then there are, you know, God love them, the Philadelphia Inquirer, for whom I've reviewed, where perhaps exists more as a consumer guide, and a lot of the reviews in a daily paper do exist as a consumer guide. And then perhaps the New York Times Book Review is sort of in the middle, which can't quite fully decide what it wants to be and can go back or forth. But I do, you know, because we were discussing, if I had been reviewing Andy's book, what would I have done with the plot points? And the truth is, I probably would have felt an obligation to talk about them and to betray them. Sorry.
Well, thank you so
I'm
much.
I'm sorry.
I'm so glad you didn't review it.
Because I would have felt, but this is only my one perspective of one reviewer, and I'm always clear to people to say, whenever you read any review anywhere, you need to remind yourself you're just reading one person's opinion. But it was the what would seem to me the unnatural limits that I would have to go into and put myself through, sort of the coyness within the space of a review, to talk about it without talking about it, would make it difficult for me to engage with the book in a way that I would find satisfying. I'm not saying it couldn't be done. I'm not saying there aren't reviewers who could or would do that. That's certainly not a review I'd be interested in writing. And I think we can even get away with that here because this is a broader conversation. It's not specifically about the one thing. Whereas if we really were just deconstructing the story of a marriage, it would be a lot more frustrating to sort of have a gag rule on us. But we also talked about John Updike's Rules of Reviewing in the back, which are famous, and I urge all of you to Google them and read them, because whether you're a reviewer or just a reader of reviews, I think they're indispensable. The most famous of which is he says, never criticize someone for failing to do something they did not set out to do. But one of his other points is never reveal, be sparing with plot, and never ever reveal the ending. And he talks about his own fury at reviewers early on who were revealing all these great twists and turns in his story. So I understand why, as a writer who has taken the trouble to figure this out and to create, as we said earlier, this narrative that you want to engage and compel people to, then sort of have that blown by a reviewer.
By John Updike.
Yeah, you know, bastard.
He said he revealed plot points in The New Yorker, which I loved, being reviewed by John Updike, the reviewer, and The New Yorker. But why?
And I think in the case of the points that he revealed, they were not essential to the discussion of the book within the context of that New Yorker review. Like you say, a New York Review of Books review is a different animal. At, you know, 5,000 words, yes, you go into every piece of the book, but that's probably not.
Well, where do you think reviews are going now? People decry that the book review is dead.
Oh, and I think that's such hogwash. I think, well, obviously as a blogger, I'm going to speak of the benefits of reading literary websites. I'm not saying that blogs replace reviewing, because they don't. And one of the mistakes that I think mainstream reviewers make when they go all head up about this stuff is they assume bloggers are trying to do the same thing, which they're not. They're doing something different. But some of you may know a wonderful critic from Harper's named Wyatt Mason, and Wyatt just launched his own blog at Harper's called Sentences. And he ran an absolutely wonderful, fascinating post either yesterday or the day before, and I sent him an email thanking him for putting this up, where amid this hue and cry of the decline of the book review, and book reviews are collapsing and falling, from the first 3 weeks of May, he ran a total of 85,000 words of serious literary criticism that had appeared in places like, you know, yes, the New Yorker, the New York Review of Books, Atlantic, Book Forum, places like that. James Wood's Review of Netherland was in there. Cynthia Ozick's Review of the New Lionel Trilling. But this notion that within 3 weeks we have generated and can freely get to, via the internet, 85,000 words of literary criticism. Who has the time?
Well, and shows the passion is out there to read this and to talk about books. And so I'm just surprised.
I think so. Who do you feel has treated you best among your reviewers?
Oh, but that's silliness. Well, I always, you know... Well,
not for loving it necessarily, but for engaging with the book in a way that you felt did the book credit, did the book justice.
Well, oddly, in some ways, I think John Updike has a lot of really intelligent points, because he's a writer and he can tell you he sees all of your flaws. You know, he's not fooled by anything.
Do you think that novelists, only novelists should review novels? Do you think non-novelists can review novels?
I'm not sure novelists should do it in a lot of ways, because what's weird is that I don't think reviews are written to the author, the reader, written for fellow readers. And so the author is kind of out of the conversation in a way. And I think a lot of novelists are writing it, if they write a review, they're writing it to their fellow writer saying, I see what you're doing and I want to help you out here. I got some tips for you, which is a totally different conversation. And I've done it myself in writing reviews.
You've expressed, if I recall, maybe I'm wrong, but you've expressed some uneasiness and you don't quite enjoy.
Oh, what's terrible is that you write a review of something and you mixed and then you meet the person later and they're lovely and you know that they know that you know and you can never be friends. But...
You see, I think if I met someone who gave me a mix, but there was more good than not good in there, I could still be their friend.
I know. If you took
if it's more good, if
they took you seriously enough to instead of dismissing it, then you might.
Right.
You know, I have friends who are very critical of me, and we're still friends.
I think we are running into the question time. I hope that we have some questions, either for Andy or for myself. But if you do, just hold your hand up, and the lady with the roving mic will come. Oh, we have questions. Wonderful.
Thank you both for being here. When Gore Vidal was here about a year ago, being that you were talking about book reviews, he said that it's a shame that when there's so little space given in mainstream media, and I think he was talking about Time magazine, that he had just read a review that was so scathing and negative about a book. He said, why waste the few inches of column space that we have to turn people off from reading? So do you think there's any responsibility when you're reviewing to try to find the most positive entrance into a book to encourage people to read?
Oh, that's curious. I'm so sorry that I missed Gore Vidal being here, first of all. Well, I'm sort of mixed about it, because, you know, I think, well, there's a line of thought that's happened over time, that there were so many scathing reviews in the New York Review of Books, New York Times Book Review, they did it for attention, to draw attention to books, to show that there was an argument and a passion about them and that people were, you know, sort of like the way that British authors and critics get into it over there. And I think there was a thought that it would get people excited about books, and there was a backlash against it, which was, why are we, we should ignore books we don't like, and we should point out books that we love and be enthusiasts about books, and that will get people into books, and we'll talk about why we love them. And I think now there's sort of a backlash against that, maybe.
That was sort of the ethos of the Believer magazine, which came up in, you know, the famous Critical Manifesto that launched it, sort of hoping for the death of snark in reviews. From my perspective, it's funny, years ago, before I had my own blog, I left a comment on somebody else's blog. This is how obscure this was. This was a comment on a blog called The Antic Muse. And I made a vaguely disparaging remark about Alan Chews. And it wasn't rude, but I was sort of a little bit dismissive, because the gist of it was, I thought that every time he gets on the radio, I hear how much he loves a book, and so I don't really trust him. He emailed me, which staggered me, because I was, you know, truly a nobody and a nothing. And he emailed me to ask me to explain what I meant. And I said, well, look, for me to really connect with a critic, if I want to calibrate myself, I want to know what they don't like as well as merely what they like. And he made that argument about saying, you know, particularly with the radio, that there's so little time on the air for radio to talk about books, he would rather talk about books that he wants to, you know, promote and that he wants to give airtime to. And I respect that as a point of view. I don't agree with it, ultimately, because I do think that, you know, as we've shown here, that a healthy discussion, even friends, even people who like the same thing, need to disagree. I think it's important to disagree, and I think that enhances the conversation when there are disagreements. I don't have any use for, you know, just ad hominem, you know, the kind of stuff that Dale Peck specialized in was, you know, it won't enlighten anybody. But James Wood, who's a critic who certainly made his reputation on writing tough reviews, but I think anyone who, for the most part, anyone who ever got a negative review from Wood understood that their material was being engaged with, and that's what we talked about, that idea of really taking on and respecting the material enough to
that's
take it seriously.
That's what would be nice, is an intellectual conversation, you know, would be great.
Exactly.
And so, I don't know what the Time Magazine article was. That's, you know, what was it a review of?
One little bit of space.
Yeah, why waste that one bit of space on something he hated?
Apparently, the tenor of the review was not an intellectual discussion. It was just like,
right.
Alas, well, you won't be on the podcast without that microphone.
John Banville has said that he's now basically gotten the habit of turning down New York Review of Books assignments. If he reads a book and he really dislikes it, he won't review it. One notable exception being when he tore Ian McEwan's Saturday to shreds. But that's a case, again, of a very negative, scathing review where there was something more going on, and he wasn't just responding to the book. He was responding to sort of a hoopla around the book that he felt needed to be taken on. And I think that was an important discussion. Do we have another question? We go where the mic lady goes.
I have three questions. One's really quick.
Cool. Great.
Why did you take off your glasses for your book cover?
That's a very apt question.
Thank you.
I actually put them on, if you must know, because I have a sty in my left eye that is very uncomfortable with contact lenses. Yeah. So normally I don't wear glasses at all. Is that a good answer? It's very personal.
Well, was personal out of bounds?
Not at all.
Oh, okay.
We're talking about books here. Of course it's personal.
So my second question was, I don't think I'm giving anything away here, but at the end of the first section of your book, you identify your narrator in
mm-hmm.
a way, the very end. But she's pretty identifiable from the first page by virtue of her name. And I'm just wondering why you even needed to identify her. I mean, wasn't it? There's only certain people that would have had that name in 1950.
Sorry, we're being very vague about this same thing again. You are in the minority of people who had a sense of what was going on. But I agree with you that there was it's so hard to talk about.
I read too much. Okay.
meet us at the bar afterwards.
No,
he'll
like
explain
way
it to
too
you
much. Okay. And so my third question, it's really interesting that you read that Rosenberg section, because my third question is really about passion, which I didn't really understand Holland.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that we were supposed to. That could be one of my questions, but it isn't. At some point in the book, our narrator and protagonist experiences a certain kind of passion, physical passion. I'm trying to stay really vague here.
It's okay.
And it seems like she understands that there should be something like that in her life, and she understands the Ethel story and her passion, but somehow doesn't seek it in her own life.
Doesn't act out on it.
In any way, at any time. And so I have to say that, as the critical reader that I am, I loved the book. Basically, I loved the book. But I had a nagging, lurking problem with the ambiguity of the husband and the narrator, who's extremely sympathetic and seemed intellectually very sophisticated and seemed to understand the concept of passion in her husband's life as well as in the life
but,
of Ethel
but
Rosenberg,
is not able to act herself.
But never wanted to act on
well,
herself.
Well, I have to say, I mean, I understand those. But those are, I sort of made a choice to go that way. One reason is that she's a 70-year-old woman looking back on her young self. And so she's forgiving of things that she was not able to do at the time. Because of the time she was in. I also think that she's she has this idea of passion that this man who comes into their life, a family, an old friend of her husband's, starts to sort of subvert their lives through information and insinuated himself in there. And he also starts to seduce her in a way with a fantasy of what her life could be that I think is a fantasy in a lot of ways that she falls for and rejects. And I think the husband at the center, who is truly ambiguous, they talk about him at one point as he's very attractive. And so he's always been able to have people react to him because he's so attractive. And he actually has no real self. He's able to just reflect back on people their own desires and doesn't have much that he desires himself. And so he's sort of all people to all other people. And I was thinking of someone in my life in particular, and that's who I wanted to capture in that way. So I understand, but the ambiguity for me was at the heart of the book.
I'd also maybe just add in as a reader that for me, one of the themes that I took away from the book, you know, if you remember, Andy talks a lot about cowards, shirkers, you know, conscientious objectors play a role in this book, but they're generally perceived as cowards, shirkers, and this whole notion that they don't face their duty, they're not doing their duty. And really, this book is sort of filled with characters who are conscientious objectors from their own lives, that they're shirkers from facing and looking at the difficult truths of their own lives. And so I think that some of that may also stem from that. You know, you're not going to see clearly that which you are kind of holding at arm's length until it's, you know, too late or much later. And I think that may also be something to think about. No, I'm talking about the main story. I'm talking.
She was, but it was tough. It was interesting reading the paper at the time about Ethel Rosenberg, because people were really split down the middle about women were about how they felt about her. She was a very shameful character to a lot of women, and she was also in some ways a hero to some people at the time. I think now we have a very different view of her as a martyr, but at the time, a lot of women saw her as sacrificing her son's future for her husband, which was seen as unthinkable. And I really was interested in that take on her in the paper of the time.
I think we had a question over here, gentleman down here.
This question is for either of you. You talked about revealing certain info and not revealing certain info and where that goes. How do you determine what to reveal as far as character biographical details and, you know, behavioral quirks, as opposed to letting the audience maybe figure out certain things, or kind of just giving this whole Freudian analysis of how they are? How do you walk that line?
It's really tough. So this is a sort of, are you a writer yourself?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a sort of a writing question. It's a tough one. I think I started out giving lots and lots and lots of information, and sometimes I cut it out, and I'm more and more tempted to get very little. Because I think I've realized, I mean, I think books are this great thing, doesn't happen in a lot of other media, where the reader is inventing half of everything that you're doing. So they are, every time you talk about, oh, he walked into the room, he was wearing a hat and he had blue eyes, well, we see him, the reader does, and it's not the person the writer has in mind. So in a way, if you give too much, you're ruining that effect. So you want to give just enough that they create the whole person and then you stop. But I've sort of started to draw back on doing long backstories and analyses, hoping that it's even better to have someone just show up and be the character without any excuses.
Yeah, I sort of went, I think, too far in the minimalist direction myself. I mean, but this, my book for me, it was really about his emotional state. That's what I was interested in. And so I found that I just wasn't that interested in that many of the physical details. I mean, it was frankly a big hassle for me to even figure out what he did for a living, and debated whether or not, but I couldn't have a, you know, 40-something-year-old guy in L.A. living in Bel Air and not talk about what he does for a living. So, you know, it was the same thing. I would say I would agree with Andy from the perspective of giving sort of just enough to get the story rolling. But, and funny, one of my reviewers sort of called me on it a little bit in the Philadelphia Inquirer. She gave me a lovely review, and I'm very grateful. But she said, some of Harry's biographical details, especially his parents, his family, are really kind of glossed. And I wanted to write her an email and say, my dear, you are nailed me. Damn right. And I'm not interested in doing that again. I am interested in digging deeper for the next book. So it'll be interesting to see how the two compare.
I always end up writing all of it and then cutting all of it out.
I think you have to know it.
Yeah.
Whether or not it gets in the book, you know, you have to be able to answer those questions about your character. And I suspect there are too many questions you could ask me about Harry where the answer might well be, I don't know, I'm not sure. Maybe I'll come back to him. So.
Maybe last question.
Time for one more question?
My question is mostly to Andrew, but it could be...
Of course it is.
...for Mark as well. I'm curious as to your writing experience with this book, as to what revealed itself when. So when you were launching into, say, your first draft, how much did you know about these plot revelations, and how much did you know about these characters who appeared through the course of the book, or did they kind of reveal themselves as you proceeded?
He's another writer, by the way, so it's another writer question.
Yeah. It's well, then you know the answer, probably. I don't have a very magical thought about when people talk about that the characters are moving around on the page and acting on their own. It seems impossible to me. But there is the sensation you have that when you're writing the book, very surprising things happen. And usually it becomes a crisis for me that it's not going the way I planned it. And I start a new draft over again, and what I've always learned is I have to kind of confront and accept those moments as possibly the way the book should go. So some of the revelations I came across as I did it, as with and Max Tivoli, the same thing happened to me. And then you rework the book so it's more natural. You couldn't just do it there. It wouldn't make any sense. But usually what's happening is something doesn't make sense in the book. There's no explanation for it. And then you have some idea, and you think that's crazy, that would ruin everything, I'd have to start all over, and that is always the way you have to go, or I have to go, and it's terrifying.
It won't leave you alone until you try it.
Yeah, you go right off the cliff over and over. But some I knew about and planned carefully, and it was so much fun to do those, because I knew it was all carefully planned out, you know. So part of, as you know, part of both.
Well, great, well, thank you very much for coming. I think
thank
there
you
will
all
be
coming.
Book signing outside.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.